based on expediency, or anyone he wouldn't expend if it served his purposes. Now with y'all. And I assume you were behind the explosion. Move against him, he is likely to continue to react very violently, especially as I believe he is wounded and somewhere in hiding. It is a dangerous time to be his ally or confidant, and that is why I'm here, Sandrine. I will not waste time telling you I believe in what you're doing, or that I feel you will be a better First Citizen than Villeneuve, but I believe I can make a deal with you, and that you will be less likely to suddenly order my execution if we are successful. I considered making my own play for power, but I like the resources and preparation that you clearly have, even after the failure of your coup and the damage caused to your network. A pause. I will settle for number two position. If I support you and we succeed, you will name me Chancellor. Those are my terms. Ciara was surprised, a little that she wasn't being gunned down by Foudre Rouge or Sector 9 thugs, but mostly at what Velashon had said. She'd been prepared to do her best to persuade him to support her openly, or at least covertly. She hadn't expected one so close to Villeneuve to be ready to throw in with her completely. Or to have his price so carefully determined. She was edgy about offering him the number two spot in her government, assuming she survived long enough to establish one. She knew Velashon well enough, and his decision to hold back from a play on the top spot was in no way a guarantee against future treachery. All things considered, she'd have preferred someone less ambitious and less capable in the Chancellor's post. But she needed allies, and Velashon was a powerful one, all the more useful because Villeneuve probably expected his support. Very well, André. Support me fully with all your resources and capabilities, and I will appoint you Chancellor. Her new ally nodded. Then it is done, First Citizen. My first advice, paramount above all things right now, is simple in theory, though likely difficult in fact. Before we make any kind of overt move on the First Citizen's chair, we have to kill Gaston Villeneuve. She has to be dead, Ambassador. There can't be much doubt she was behind the explosion. It was a higher magnitude option than we'd anticipated, but for all the collateral damage, perhaps one with a higher likelihood of success. The real question is, did Gaston Villeneuve really escape as the media reports claim, or did she actually manage to get him? Kyle Corbin had been sitting with Karevsky for hours, going through every report, every news broadcast, trying to get some idea what was going on. What was actually going on? They had no real idea of the situation, but the one thing they both knew for certain was they couldn't trust anything the Union media said. They'd sweated things out for the first couple days, the enraged mob outside worked up by early reports suggesting the Confederation had been responsible for the bombing, and looking as though they'd storm the embassy at any moment. Karevsky hadn't relished the thought of the fallout from Confederation Marines gunning down Union civilians, and even less the idea of being literally torn to pieces by that same enraged mob. I'm not so sure, Kyle. She's pretty resourceful. Karevsky wondered if his analysis of Ciara was impartial, or if it was colored by his affection for her. He wanted to believe she was still alive, but he'd never allowed desires to distort his analysis before. There wasn't any question, though. The more important mystery was Gaston Villeneuve's fate. If the dictator had been killed, the Union would likely slip into chaos as multiple parties struggled to take his place. Whatever happened and whoever prevailed, it was almost certain to be a positive for the Confederation. Villeneuve's hatred for the Union's longtime enemy bordered on pathological, and while Karevsky didn't doubt the Confederation could handle any Union aggression, with the discovery of the hegemony, the situation had become far more complex. If the Confederation ever had to face both nations at the same time, not even considering what else might lurk out there, farther coreward, the results would be disastrous. He didn't fool himself that any change in the Union would usher in more freedom for its people. But almost anyone would be less of a danger to the Confederation than Villeneuve. And if Sandrine is still alive, and if she somehow manages to seize control after all, we might just be able to work something out. He didn't have any doubt Ciara would sign a long-term treaty with the Confederation, in return for aid to prop up the Union's ever-teetering economy and her new and fragile regime. We have to know, Kyle. Send out some agents. Tell them to be careful. But we need to know if Villeneuve is alive or dead. He paused. And we need to know about Sandrine Ciara as well. At least I need to know. Chapter 34 Iborn Flagship Sargavon, Imperial System GH-8-14F3. Year of the Firstborn 384. 322 AC. The Battle of Pharsalon. The Kill.
All delivery vehicles fully armed and prepared to launch on your command, Grand Admiral.
Tesseract didn't move. Didn't look over at the Thrall at the tactical station. The ship's crew, the technicians and specialists who operated the vast craft, were as nothing to him, expendable supplicants drawn from the vast hordes of worshippers. Simply serving the Highborn in such close proximity was an honor, one worthy any danger, any death.
You may launch on both targets.
Tesseract wasn't sure what effect the bombardment would have on the actions of the Hegemony fleet. He saw very little value in a world of some hundreds of millions of the lower creatures, though no doubt the enemy combatants, also of such lesser stature, might feel differently. Indeed, Tesseract was confident they would. Any distraction, any diversion of resources in an attempt to intercept the delivery vehicles would only speed the destruction of the enemy fleet. Then, once their military assets were destroyed, the Hegemony would lay helpless before his forces. The reordering of the human society could begin in earnest, and those billions of inhabitants who survived would learn to take their places as supplicants and worshippers. Their obedience would be forged in the blood of those who resisted, their worship in the growing recognition that the Highborn were their superiors, as gods destined to rule over them, and to shepherd them into the future. Sargavon shook, a slight vibration that Tesseract's superior senses detected. He very much doubted any of the Thralls had felt the delivery vehicles launching. The missiles were massive, equipped with all manner of electronic countermeasures to thwart interception. They carried multiple antimatter warheads, over 1,000 in each. 3, perhaps 4 of the giant missiles could wipe a world completely clean of its population and artificial structures, and over 200 of them were now heading toward the target planets.
So much for distraction as a tactic. Now it was time to unleash the final blow, to trap the enemy fleet, to turn a victory into extermination. It is time.
His voice was deep, booming across the vast space of the ship's control center.
Initiate Phase 4. As you command.
A moment later.
Phase 4 initiated, Grand Admiral. All commands confirm.
Tesseract stared straight ahead, his demeanor cold, unreadable as it always was. But in his thoughts, deep within his exceedingly capable and complex Highborn mind, he prepared to savor his favorite part of such operations. The kill.
Commander Kronos, we're detecting multiple launches from the enemy fleet. They appear to be physical constructs. The AI's best projection is they are delivery vehicles for planetary bombardment warheads.
Kronos had already written off the population of Pharsalon, though the immediacy of the danger to the people there still jabbed at him, wearing down his resolve. Could he really sit there and make no effort to save them, however unlikely success might be? Then he glanced at the display, and he froze. The giant missiles were not just heading for Pharsalon. They were also targeting Planet 7.
All ships in Quadrant 9, commence interception operations at once. I want those missiles destroyed.
He knew he was drawing strength away from the main fight, reducing his fleet's already slim chances of prevailing in the battle raging all around. And a few seconds later he saw more waves of missiles, and he knew the chances of intercepting them all were slim. But Planet 7 represented 40 years of work, trillions upon trillions of Hegemony credits, and thousands of Arbiter killed during construction operations on its inhospitable surface. It was almost irreplaceable, and critically important to the war effort. The loss of 300 million civilians, after all those lost already, would hurt, but an inability to keep the fleet supplied with antimatter would dash any hopes of saving the 700 billion citizens of the Hegemony. Kronos watched as the ships in the designated division executed his orders, veering off from their courses, at least as quickly as thrust and existing velocities allowed. Almost immediately he saw a missile targeted and destroyed, and then another. But he knew the calculus of the situation. Those missiles were big, and the warheads they carried were almost certainly enormously powerful, probably antimatter-armed. His people could destroy half of the vehicles, or 3/4, or even 95%. But enough would get through to devastate the two planets. Kronos looked away from Planet 7, his eyes moving back to the main battle area, just in time to see a pair of his battleships wink off the screen. The fight was still raging all around, and his people were drawing blood themselves, but it was becoming clearer with every passing moment that his forces weren't going to prevail.
But in that moment he saw Ilias's ships moving up, driving right through the enemy fire, losing four of their big ships in the process. But then the reserves moved into their own range and over 100 ships opened up with railgun batteries, every one of them double-loaded, their super-heavy metal projectiles streaking through space at unimaginable velocities. And when one of those shots struck, even the nearly invulnerable hulls of the other ships gave way. One of the enemy ships in the forward group was struck by 3 shots in rapid succession. The vessel shook hard and then split open like an egg. 2 more of the other's vessels followed in explosions of such magnitude, Kronos could only imagine what the scanner readings would have said. He felt a moment's satisfaction, and his hands clenched reflexively into fists as he silently urged Ilias and his warriors forward. Then he saw the price they were paying. No fewer than 10 capital ships, 2 monitors, and 8 battleships were gone. Just gone. And 2 dozen other vessels had suffered some degree of damage. Some of that had happened during the early stages of the advance, when the enemy could fire and Ilias's ships could not. Things had moved closer to even. But not close enough. Kronos watched as another of the black speckled blue beams of energy tore through one of the already damaged monitors. The massive vessel shuddered. And then nothing. For a few seconds, Kronos thought the ship might survive. Then it vanished in a searing blast of pure energy, and when the miniature sun was gone, nothing remained except for a cloud of extremely hard radiation. But the rest of Ilias's ships were plunging into the battle, looking very much like they intended to fight to the bitter end. Unless he called them off, gave the order to run.
Admiral, the Hegis, the hegemony forces, are fighting well, better than we could have expected, but they're still going to lose.
Atara had walked the 3 meters from her post to Baron's command chair. She stood next to him, leaning over, her lips millimeters from his ear. His words were for him only, and for all of Dauntless's technology and equipment, the quickest and easiest way to deliver them was still to walk over and whisper to him.
I know, Atara.
Baron had turned his head slightly, his voice almost as soft as hers. But there's nothing we can do about that.
Are you sure, Tyler? We could.
We have been expressly forbidden to intervene, to even engage the enemy in any situation absent a direct and intentional attack against us. There is nothing we can do. Baron paused, almost consumed by frustration. The urge to order his ships forward, to disregard his orders, was overwhelming. Duty held him back, discipline. And the realization that simply leading his ships forward into the already wild melee would achieve nothing except the destruction of his entire force. The enemy was simply too powerful, too concentrated in the center. He knew what he had to do. His fleet had collected enough data, more than it could ever use. The rules of engagement were clear. His decision had been made for him months before on the Senate floor.
Admiral Travis.
He turned his head and he looked right at Atara, his eyes no more than 4 or 5 centimeters from her own. The fleet will prepare to withdraw. The rear line will begin transiting as soon as the ships are in position. He could see the hesitation, feel the pain and tension almost radiating off his friend and comrade. She had been almost inveterately hostile to the hegemony, against any chance of siding with them. Now she wanted to dash forward, to plunge into the battle. But she didn't argue. She just nodded her head and turned back toward her own seat. Baer knew she understood as well as he did. They had no other choice. The engineer looked through the clear hyperpolycarbonate of the dome, up into the fiery red sky, streaked as usual with gray-white trails of toxic gases. The planet was a nightmare, a vision of hell itself, but it was one of the most important places in the hegemony. And according to the scanner reports, it was about to be bombarded by waves of enemy missiles. Much of the vast antimatter production facility was underground, bored deep into the planet's bedrock. It would take an enormous amount of destructive energy to knock it out entirely, though smaller targeted impacts could cause significant damage to transmission lines and other critical systems. Vigius was a hegemony master, and the head of engineering at the sprawling antimatter foundry, but at that moment all he could do was look up into the planet's impenetrable haze, his eyes squinting, trying to detect some sign of warheads descending toward the surface. That was foolish, he knew, a pointless effort in more ways than one. But the reports had also confirmed the destruction of the orbital fortresses. All of them. The planet's defenses were gone, the ships posted around it destroyed. There were no options left. No modes of defense remaining available. Nothing but to gaze up the sky, searching for signs of approaching death. Vigius was somewhat typical of his exalted caste in hegemony society. He'd been cocky as a young man, arrogant, overly proud of the genes inside him, an advantage for which he could claim no personal credit. Much of that had mellowed with age, as the cumulative effects of his own misjudgments, mixed with some examples of clearly brilliant work by many of the high-level Arbiterana staff, had given him cause to think. He still believed in the hegemonic system. There was simply too much proof, far too many clear correlations between strong genetics and intelligence, ability. But it was far less an exact science than he'd once believed. His thoughts were strangely philosophical for a man facing imminent death. Or maybe not, he thought. What else is there to fill these last moments? He wasn't a warrior, though he knew enough about the current military situation to entertain the thought that he was actually fortunate. If there were antimatter warheads even then descending from orbit, his end would come quickly, as it would for all of his people. For the rest of the hegemony, from the Kriegeri and the warships fighting all around the system, to the billions living on planets across a vast swath of space, there would be continued terror and anguish. Some would also die quickly when their times came, and others in agony, screaming in pain and uncontrolled fear. How is this possible? We're the pinnacle, the society destined to rebuild humanity, to restore the glory of the Empire, while avoiding its terrible mistakes. He'd always believed that, supported the hegemony's sacred purpose with all his heart. Now all he saw was the hubris, the uncontrolled arrogance. Why do we always think we know more than we do? In our way, while speaking so boldly of the need to avoid the Empire's course, what have we done but emulated it, taking from them the unshakable belief that we are always right? Now we will pay the price, as the Empire did before us. He heard the klaxons in the background, the alarm system calling the staff to the underground bunkers. Vigius twitched, his body's reflexes trying to respond to the warning call. But his intellect was still in charge, and he knew there was no point. No need to spend the final seconds of his life crawling into a doomed hole in the ground. He took a breath, sucking in a lungful of the station's sterile artificial air. But in his mind it was the spring breeze of his homeworld. How many things did I ignore, fail to appreciate? How many things I planned to do were left undone? We think so highly of ourselves, yet we are so fragile, we have so little time. As he continued his thoughts, his eyes caught something, a trail of light, a flaming sparks as one of the warheads came down through the planet's dense atmosphere. Some of those warheads will be set for airburst, others for burrowing mode. It was a realization of no real value, and yet it was worth all he had left, the difference between dying in minutes or dying in seconds. His mind raced. Every person in his life to whom he still had something to say, staring at him from the dark reaches, every decision he regretted, pushing its way to the forefront of his thoughts. He could hear his heart pounding, and as he wiped the sweat from his forehead, he could feel that his hands, too, were wet with perspiration. He was afraid, as scared as he'd ever been. And yet there was peace there, too, a strange calm. He ached not for himself, nor for his people on the planet, but for the others, still doomed to fight a hopeless war, to endure just long enough to see all they knew, all they'd lived for and cared about, destroyed. His thoughts slipped back, wondering if the incoming bombs were set to burrow or... He never completed that thought. In an instant, it was all gone. Vigius, the building he was in, every surface structure in any direction for kilometers upon kilometers, obliterated in the unimaginable fury of matter-antimatter annihilation. Chapter 35. Senate Compound. Troyes City. Megara, Oleus 3. Year 322 AC.
What you did was outrageous, Captain. I will see that you are clapped in irons. You can deliver that brat you're carrying in the deepest, darkest cell in the detention center.
Kettle Vaughn was apoplectic. Andy had considered ignoring the Senate's demand that she appear, but she knew her work wasn't done, not until the politicians voted to authorize the fleet to go to Tyler's aid. She'd backed them into a corner with a broadcast, maneuvered them to the edge of the precipice. Now it was time to push them over. Vaughn's words came at her, almost like a fuel stoking her own volatile rage. Andy was not the kind to take abuse, to stand helplessly while some miserable fool threatened her. Not even when that fool was a Confederation senator. She'd killed men for less, far less, and she wouldn't have lost a night's sleep for putting Vaughn in his grave either. But killing a senator in the middle of the compound would have a lot of complications, and it wouldn't do anything for Tyler. So she just took it, or at least what Andy LaFarge considered taking it. but that was only going to go so far. Senator Vaughn, you can threaten me all you want, but I've faced some really intimidating people in my life and live to tell about it. If you think a pompous buffoon of a politician from some industrial shithole, especially one with such unfortunate taste in suits, is going to make the grade, you're sorely mistaken. You are too stupid to realize it, of course, but you're actually in my debt. My solution was more elegant and probably a lot less unpleasant for you than the others you might have faced. I realize that your particular breed of Elvincian boarworm doesn't understand loyalty, Senator, but do you really think the Navy, the Marines, were going to let you ignore Tyler's request for aid? Did you think they would allow you to dicker and debate endlessly while the danger grew ever more dire? You're too stupid and too arrogant to realize that your Senate rank does not make you invulnerable, regardless of what you tell yourself in the mirror when you're shaving. Now, do you want to keep threatening me and pretending that you've got enough inside your entire worthless sack of blood and guts to scare me? Or do you want to do what you already know you have to do? Because if we don't resolve this today in exactly the way I want it, I swear to God, you worthless maggot, I will go from one end of the Confederation to the other and tell the people exactly how the Senate abandoned their great hero and tried to manhandle his pregnant wife. Vaughn stepped back a bit, his face a mask of astonishment. And he knew he was accustomed to people pandering to him and kissing his ass, and she wondered if anybody had ever spoken to him quite the way she just had. Or had enjoyed it as much. Or if he was capable of understanding that what he just heard was her holding back and taking it. Anything that didn't end with a blade deep in his chest cavity pretty much qualified as that. There was a tense quiet for a moment, and then a voice cut through the quiet. Senator Vaughn, whatever your feelings about Captain Lafarge's actions, I dare say she had left us with few options. Senator Avaria has already promised her support for the measure to send reinforcements to Admiral Barron and to authorize him to negotiate an alliance with the Hegemony and deploy his forces to battle however he deems appropriate. If you join us, the matter will pass by a large margin, and perhaps the other factions will yield to the inevitable and allow us to pass the authorization unanimously. I don't like the thought of another war any more than you do, but I can't imagine Admiral Barron does either. If he sees a threat, it is very likely a real one, best faced hundreds of light years from here before it ends up on our doorstep. And he watched as Speaker Flandry spoke to his colleague. Flandry was somewhat of an ally, though she suspected he too was secretly enraged at the way she'd gone around them, boxed them in. She also didn't care. Flandry was enough of a realist to know he didn't have a choice, but she couldn't imagine the politician, no less arrogant in his own way than Vaughn, if somewhat smarter, was happy with her either. She just didn't care. She was slightly more disposed to the speaker than she was to vermin like Vaughn, but all things considered, she wouldn't shed a tear if the whole Senate fell into a volcano somewhere. At least after they gave her the vote she needed. Senators, I understand you all work on a different schedule than productive elements of society, but can we move this along, please? Admiral Winters is waiting to hear from me, and if there is a problem, I feel duty-bound to make another address and tell the people of the Confederation what is happening here. So, I guess now we'll see if any of you have the guts to actually try to arrest me and try to get me to recant what I said. You don't have a hole deep or dark enough for that. Thank you, Clint. It's far from ideal, but it's the best I can manage. Andy was usually extremely adept at hiding weaknesses, but she knew that wall was crumbling, that her sadness was fully on display to her friend. She handed the data chip to Winters. It was just about the last way she wanted to tell Tyler he was going to be a father, but it was her only choice. She couldn't go with the fleet, not without exposing the baby she carried to terrible hazards in the transit points. She'd thought about not telling him, of waiting until they were together again, whenever that would be. She told herself that would be a mercy, that would spare him pain, prevent distraction while he was leading his forces. But too many people in the fleet already knew, and the idea of him finding out by accident was even more upsetting than delivering the news by recorded message. Andy, I know this is difficult for you, not only because the prospect of a new conflict is a grim development for all of us, but because you are not the kind to stay behind out of the fight. But there's no other way, not now, and you know it. So take care of yourself and try to think positively. That's what Tyler would want, and you know it. And he winced slightly. Winters' last comments had been well-meaning, but it had also been somewhat of a low blow. I know that, Clint. It is hard to stay back to sit here while everyone I know and care about is going off to fight. But it's more than that. Another war? So soon after the last one? Won't we ever have peace? Some time just to live? And he had spent most of her life pursuing what she wanted. That had mostly been about surviving in her days back in the gut, and then it had become a pursuit for success, for wealth. Now she had everything she'd ever wanted, and a good number of things she'd never imagined. She was enormously wealthy. She had Tyler. She was even about to have a baby, something she'd hardly ever imagined. Everything about her life was good just then, save for the one thing that destroyed it all, cut across her happiness like a jagged blade. War. She'd always been a fighter, a warrior in her own right, if not exactly a disciplined soldier or spacer. But she was tired now, and all she wanted was peace, to live with her small but growing family, and the few true friends she'd acquired along her way. But as she sat there, that seemed an impossible goal. Everyone close to her was a warrior of one kind or another, and now they would all face hardship and danger. Again. She looked up at Winters, and despite her best efforts, she couldn't hold back the tears.
Please, Clint. Tell Tyler I'm okay. Don't let him know I'm so weak.
You're the farthest thing I know from weak, Andy. Let me tell you a secret, one thing I've come to learn from a lifetime in service. Fighting is hard on us, the pain, the loss, the stress. But it's harder on those we leave behind. We think of our comrades, those we lost, and those wounded, hurt. But it is too easy to forget spouses and children and parents back home. They suffer as we do, perhaps even more so. And for you, one so used to being in the fight, I can't imagine what you're feeling. Winters paused, and Andy felt a wave of appreciation for his words, and even more for his obvious but welcome effort to pretend he didn't notice she was crying.
Thank you, Clint. A pause. I mean it.
Ease up on yourself, Andy. What you did was incredible. You've done more for the Confederation with that maneuver than anyone else in any of this, and even more for Tyler. Even here, kept away from the front, you fought the fight, and you won. She leaned forward and hugged the Admiral, planting a kiss on his cheek.
Thank you,
she said again, as she pulled slowly back. Then a moment later,
so when do you leave?
Tomorrow. He managed something like a smile. I took some steps before I had authorization to make sure the fleet was provisioned and ready just in case. I guess that was forward thinking of me. Andy, against every expectation, matched his tentative grin.
Well, I guess that was handy, wasn't it?
Her face slipped back into a nondescript expression.
Take care of yourself, my friend. Come back. All of you. Please.
But even as she said it, she knew not all of them would come back. She just hoped some of them would. Chapter 36 Highborn Vessel Esceptolon, Imperial System GH-8-14-F3, Year of the Firstborn 384, 322 AC. The Battle of Pharsalon, the Flank Attack.
We're underway, Grand Admiral. Your orders are understood and will be obeyed.
Elorex sat in his chair, his massive stature greater even than Tesseract's. Even among the Highborn, the self-styled gods of the galaxy, he was an impressive sight. His implants seemed perfect, well-located, with their exoportions polished to a bright sheen. He was younger than Tesseract, not one of the Firstborn, but his abilities had powered his advancement, and placed him in command of his own attack force. He'd received his orders, and he'd acknowledged, though it would be almost an hour before the message reached Tesseract's flagship. For all the technology of the Highborn, aside from carrying messages through jump points, the speed of light remained the upper limit on communications. Elorax's ships were tasked with the final phase of the battle, the maneuver that would turn the hegemony's defeat into annihilation. The orders were clear. Emerge from the deep outer system where his ships had been hiding, and proceed toward the enemy's jump point, cutting them off, trapping their survivors in the system where they could be attacked from multiple vectors and exterminated. The command of the flanking force was an honor, a high posting for one not of the Firstborn, and Helorax was determined to make full use of it. He'd run the calculations three times, just in his head, of course. It was nothing more than basic third-level differential vector calculus, and the results had been the same. His ships would arrive before the enemy could reach the jump point. There was no chance the hegemony fleet would escape. Only a single variable had remained, the force that had remained out of the fight, sitting just inside the jump point while the battle raged. Those ships would have been close enough to intervene, but the scanners confirmed the data he'd received a few minutes earlier. They were already retreating through the jump point. Indeed, most of them had already gone. Perhaps the hegemony forces had detected his flanking force, realized that their main fleet was doomed. The vessels that had departed were few relative to the size of the force that would be destroyed, but Helorax was relieved to be rid of them. Their positioning had placed them well to interfere with his flank attack, even to threaten his entire force. It was a pity that even such a small force should escape. But once those vessels were gone and his own ships were firmly in position, the die would be cast. The cream of the hegemony's strength would be destroyed, leaving only scattered forces to defend over 400 inhabited planets. The Highborn would move forward to victory, and the humans, the vast masses of genetically inferior animals, would learn the new reality. They would learn to serve and worship the Highborn. For eternity. All ships maintain fire double loads on all shots. Ilias had lost 31 ships. 28 of them had fallen to enemy fire and 3 to the breathtakingly dangerous practice of jamming in double-strength antimatter loads before firing his railguns. He'd counted at least 6 different ways the reckless tactic had backfired, sometimes causing moderate damage and others total disaster. But he'd also seen the effects on the targeted enemy ships. The other ships were enormously powerful, far more advanced than the hegemony's own. But when one of those railgun shots slammed into the hull at twice the normal velocity, even the hardened shielded alloy of the enemy warships shattered and vaporized. The hit rates were up too, in addition to the higher damage inflicted by each impact. The other ships had seemed almost like something untouchable, otherworldly, but his people had gunned down enough of them to put that particular view to rest. They were superior, far stronger than his own ships. They had massive advantages in combat. But they could be killed. Nicarus, Lovinus, and Trangus report railguns out of action, Commander. Trangus indicates a possibility of restoration. The other two ships will require several months in space dock to repair their weapon systems. Ilias didn't respond, and he took mercy on himself and didn't try to calculate the odds on any of his damaged ships reaching a space dock. He was about to order all ships whose railguns were down to advance and engage with secondary weapon systems, but a glance at the display told him they were already doing just that. Advance for his ships actually meant deceleration first, and then acceleration in the opposite direction, back toward the transit tube. His fleet had reached the enemy position at high speed and zipped right by. Now all his ships were blasting their engines, working down their velocities along the vector leading in system. And his ships without railguns were in the lead, diverting all available energy to engines, struggling to close with the enemy and stay in the fight somehow. Ilias had always felt pride in his Grigri, but now that swelled beyond what he'd experienced before. He'd wondered how his warriors, always brave but also always the stronger combatant, would handle facing a superior enemy. He'd been concerned that their resolve would crumble, that they would not be able to match the grim endurance the Rim Dwellers had shown in similar circumstances. That doubt was gone. Utterly. Facing overwhelming odds had brought something out from deep within his Kriegery fighters, a strength he'd never seen before. No, not never. You saw it in Baron's warriors. His people had done their best, better than he'd dared to expect. But as he looked out across the display, a conclusion solidified in his mind. It's not going to matter. The battle is lost. His people had blooded the enemy. No more than that, they had hit the invaders hard, but they'd paid a staggering price for that, and his ships were too badly damaged, his crews too exhausted to continue much longer. He had to pull out. He had to get his fleet back where he could reorder his formations and repair at least some of the damage suffered. But he did nothing. He just sat and watched his ships continue the fight. They were too far in with no real chance to escape. His only choice was to die running or die fighting. And that was no choice at all. Kronos knew the battle was over. All that remained was to determine what remained of hegemony military power. If he lost his entire fleet, his people were doomed, whatever dim hopes remained extinguished utterly. The forces that remained back at Calphron and scattered through all the inhabited systems of the hegemony were too few, too weak to mount a reasonable defense, at least without a core of the fleet he now commanded. His people had fought hard, and in many ways they had done better than he dared to hope. Now it was time to save as many of them as he could. The dash back to the transit tube would be costly and dangerous, but he was sure he could get a good number of ships out, if he gave the order immediately. But Ilias's ships were the problem. His friend's ships had moved deeper in system than any other hegemony forces, carried past the enemy line by their high velocities. He would order Ilias to withdraw as his own forces did, but he knew as he gazed at the positions of those ships, they would suffer terribly on their journey back to the jump point. It was even possible they would be wiped out. But there is no other choice. It is time to order the retreat. Commander, scanners are picking up enemy ships inbound from the outer system. A pause, then, in an even more emotional tone.
They're heading toward the transit tube, Commander. They're positioning themselves between us and our line of retreat.
Kronos' head swung around wildly, his eyes moving to the end of the display and focusing on the new contacts. It was a sizable force, not as large as the main fleet units he was facing, but big enough to blast his worn and damaged ships to bits as they raced toward it, and passed it to the tube. And they wouldn't be alone. The main enemy fleet would be on his tail, pursuing his fleeing ships. His forces would be trapped between the ships on their tails and the flanking force. He'd be lucky if a dozen ships made it out of the system.
It was a trap and you fell right into it. Fool!
His thoughts were dark, his self-recriminations merciless. He'd lost the fleet in a single battle. He'd destroyed the hegemony. He watched as the last of Baron ships moved through the tube. He didn't blame the Confederation commander. He'd exceeded an order or two himself in his time, but he'd never committed treason. He felt a spark of resentment at the Confeds for leaving his people to their deaths, but it didn't last. His warriors in the system, very likely about to die, had been the enemies of Baron and his spacers, killed their friends and comrades. The Rim dwellers might have agreed to help and they might have made a difference. But there wasn't time to get over the past, to find a way forward. Kronos turned back to the main section of the display. He almost ordered his forces to stand where they were, to fight until the very end. But even without significant hope, he had to make a run for the tube. If he could get 20 ships out, or 10, or even one, it was better than nothing. Some way to keep the fight going, even without hope of victory.
Admiral, all main fleet units have transited. Only Dauntless, Repulse, and Indomitable remain in the system.
Baron could hear the frustration in Atara's voice, the unspoken message screaming somehow from her perfectly on-point words. We should not be running. Baron agreed, almost more than he could endure. But now wasn't the time for treason, if there ever was such a time. The Confederation faced a new enemy. There wasn't any doubt in his mind about that, and strife between the fleet and the Senate could only hamper the war effort. When they saw all the data he had collected, even the most recalcitrant senators would have to acknowledge the danger. He'd always believed the best way to handle politicians was to scare the hell out of them. That wouldn't be hard. He was a combat veteran of 2 decades' service, and he was scared to death. Advise Repulse and Indomitable they may transit when ready. There was no particular reason to hold Dauntless back, but somehow it helped him being the last to transit, the last to abandon the old enemy, the hegemony warriors he was rapidly coming to think of more as allies. Kronos is no fool. He's done some real damage to the enemy, convinced his warriors they can hurt the others. They'll do better next time. He'll pull back, I guess is any time now. He'll make a run for the transit point, pull his fleet out, battered, but still a force in being. There would be another fight, Baron was sure of it, and with any luck, his forces and the rest of the Confederation fleet would take their places in the battle line. Atara relayed the order to the 2 other battleships herself. Her tone was deadpan, totally without emotion. He'd served at her side in multiple battles, victories and defeats alike, but he'd never seen her look so beaten. Baron took a deep breath and he looked one last time at the display, at the hegemony fleet, for so long a feared and hated enemy, fighting with all the spirit and courage anyone could ask of veteran warriors. There was still resentment. He suspected some of that would remain all his life, but his respect was continuing to grow. He held his gaze as one more enemy ship and 4 of Kronos' battleships vanished from the screen in the continuing melee. Then his eyes dropped to the deck. Atara, bring us around in line behind Repulse. We'll transit immediately after—
Admiral!
Baron's head swung around, trying to determine where the voice came from. His eyes settled on Ensign Caravel, the most junior officer on Dauntless's bridge.
Enemy ships, sir. At least I'd bet they're enemy ships, coming in from the deep outer system.
Baron looked back at the display, and he saw it. At least 40 contacts, looking very much like the others' ships. I think you're right, Ensign. He turned toward Atara. His first impulse was to order his last 3 ships to accelerate, to expedite their transit. But the words that came out were completely different. Repulse and Indomitable are to abort transit and decelerate to station-keeping velocity.
Yes, Admiral.
There was an energy in Atara's voice, one that hadn't been there a few seconds before. One Baron understood, but also thought misplaced. He knew she wanted to engage, to come to the aid of the hegemony fleet, something he thought amusing considering the rage she'd still nursed when they'd first arrived. But 3 Confederation ships moving against more than 3 dozen enemy vessels was no cause for celebration. All ships are to launch full spreads of probes. I want all the data we can get on those ships. But even without the enhanced scans, the reams of analysis the AIs would pump out, Baron already knew what was happening. The enemy had beaten the hegemony fleet to the system, at least in advance force, and they'd hidden deep beyond the farthest planet, out among the comets and deep space debris surrounding the star in the vast zone between the system and interstellar space. It was a trap. The whole thing was a trap all along, and Kronos fell right into it. You would have fallen into it as well. His mind was racing, analyzing, trying to sort the information coming in too quickly to assimilate. But behind the uncertainty, the frantic confusion, a single conclusion was forming, one that struck Baron like an iron fist to the gut. The others were going to position themselves in front of the transit point. Kronos' ships would be forced to run right into the waiting guns of massed enemy ships, and they would have the rest of the others' fleet hot on their tails, firing all the way. His one assumption, the belief he had used to justify his withdrawal, to convince himself he wasn't really abandoning his new allies, was gone, replaced by one unassailable fact. None of Kronos' ships were going to escape. At least not many. Hegemony military might would be broken right in the Atara Mordlin system. The war would be as good as over before he even heard back from the Senate, before a Confederation vessel fired a single shot. Chapter 37. Temporary Government Headquarters, Liberté City. Planet Matamoral, Gassara 4. Union Year 225, 321 AC.
I want to thank you both for your support. Gaston Villeneuve has been at the very pinnacle of the Union government for more than 30 years, and I do not dispute that he has exhibited enormous drive during that time, nor that he has some accomplishments to his name. But he has caused considerable harm as well, with his unrestrained paranoia and his inveterate hostility towards the Confederation. A century of wars has stunted our economic growth, and defeat in the last of those conflicts brought us to the brink of ruin. I promise you both, and all those who support my term as First Citizen, there will be no more pointless war. I offer a future of prosperity, of growth in our economy that will rival that of the Confederation. I will see that we finally exploit long underutilized resources. I will bring nothing less than cooperation with our former enemy, and even financial support from the Confederation that enables us to grow, to create wealth, to calm a restive population. One of the men facing Sierra looked back, somewhat unconvinced from the look on his face. There is much in what you say that is cause for satisfaction, Minister Sierra, yet I question how much of it is possible. Help from the Confederation? That seems a difficult proposition. Four wars and millions dead has created considerable enmity on their side of the border as well as on ours. You are very persuasive, Sandrine. Our presence here attests to that fact. But much of what you offer seems dangerously tentative. The general stopped short of according her the First Citizen's title she'd given herself. She felt her stomach tense slightly, and she reminded herself the support she was thanking her guests for had not yet been fully given. Simply put, she still had to close the deal. She'd gained a shaky kind of control over Liberté City, and an even more tentative hold over the planet as a whole. But she was ahead of herself with the First Citizen title, and she knew it. General, I understand your concerns. These are uncertain times, and yet I believe we must rely on our trust for each other. I take you at your word that you can deliver the Liberté City garrisons and effective control of all vital military bases on the planet, as well as the orbital defense forces, which are not even under your direct command. What is served by my doubting you, by my insisting on proof you cannot provide? I know you. I understand your stature among those you claim to represent, and I take you at your word. She paused a few seconds, her eyes fixed on the general's. He looked a bit uncomfortable, and she waited until he was about to speak before she continued. But I will offer you proof, General, at least of my ability to deliver peace with the Confederation, and to obtain financial aid from them as part of an expanded and ongoing relationship. The general's tension level eased slightly, his look of skepticism replaced by one of curiosity. How can you do that, Minister? Allow me to introduce you to another of my allies, Ambassador? Alexander Karevsky walked into the room from the small antechamber. Despite the dust and debris that seemed to be everywhere in the capital, the Union representative was dressed in his finest, looking as though he was about to meet the highest authorities. Which, as far as Sandrine and her supporters were concerned, he was. General Rien, Mr. Kromas, it is a pleasure to meet you both.
I believe we've crossed paths before, General, though we were never formally introduced. Kurevsky turned his head slightly toward the third person standing around Ciara, and he nodded. Minister Velashon, it is a pleasure to see you again. The pleasure is mine, Ambassador. Velashon was the first to respond, but the others followed almost immediately. Ambassador Kurevsky, it is a surprise and a great pleasure to see you here. Rian looked for an instant as if he might extend a hand, or bow slightly or something. But in the end, he just managed a tense smile. The proper greeting for ambassadors in the middle of a coup was a matter of some question, especially when it appeared the diplomat was somehow involved in the change of government underway.
Ambassador, I have heard much about you, and I am pleased to finally meet you in person.
Adrian Chromas was an exceedingly charming woman, who exhibited an aura of kindness and moderation. It was all fake, of course. Ciara found Chromas a bit off-putting, though she knew in many ways the Sector 9 supervisor was almost a mirror image of herself. There was a short, awkward silence, and then Rian spoke.
Ambassador, I apologize for the directness of what I am about to say, but I do not believe time and circumstances offer us any useful alternatives. Minister Ciara has suggested, no, I'd say rather more than suggested, that the Confederation would provide material assistance to her new government. Is this the case?
Kurevsky looked back at Rian.
General, I hope you will appreciate that I am going to answer you as honestly and completely as I can. I am a diplomat, and in my position I have certain powers, certain discretionary assets I can employ on my own authority. I have, and I trust you will keep what I am about to say in the strictest confidence, advanced approximately 1 million Confederation credits to First Citizen CR for use in securing the new government. I have prepared a dispatch to Megara, which I will send as soon as I am able to ensure a safe passage, recommending that the Confederation government authorize me to negotiate a new treaty with the Union, one that provides for a lasting peace between our two nations, and also for ongoing financial support, both in the form of direct subsidies, and also in promoting investment in the Union by private Confederation industry. My people have never wanted to be an enemy of yours, General, and a Union government seeking peaceful coexistence and cooperation has always been our fondest wish.
Rian didn't answer immediately. Ciara watched, trying not to let her nerves show. Kurevsky hadn't offered anything truly substantive, save for revealing that he'd provided moderate funding to her operations, but she hoped it would be enough. After all, if the ambassador had promised anything more substantive, it wouldn't have been believable anyway.
Very well, Ambassador. Your honesty is refreshing, and it enhances your credibility in my view. If you are prepared to offer your personal assurance that you will pursue your stated requests with all your power and influence, he turned toward Ciara. I believe I am prepared to offer my full support. As am I,
Chromas added before Kurevsky could respond. The Confederation ambassador stood where he was, looking a bit uncomfortable, but otherwise completely steady.
I offer you my full assurance, General, and Minister, that I will do everything in my power to see that the Union receives all the economic support it needs to revitalize its economy.
Ciara was relieved as she heard Kurevsky's words. She'd managed to tape the proceedings, of course, despite her strictest assurances to both the Confed ambassador and her prospective Union allies that all surveillance systems had been deactivated. She vastly preferred persuading Rian and Chromas to throw in with her, but she also believed in backup plans. The tapes would be more than enough to ensure both of her guests met an unpleasant end if Villeneuve retained power and saw them. She hoped to avoid blackmail, but it didn't hurt to have a little something close to the vest. Kurevsky would be angry, too, if he found out. He'd been extremely reluctant to get so involved, but she'd managed to persuade him. She liked the idea of extorting her ally and lover even less than she did her other two guests, but she knew she would do what she had to do. She was close, so close to absolute power. It was like a drug and irresistible addiction. She would do anything to attain it, to feel its warm embrace. Even sacrifice those closest to her. General Rian bowed his head forward and removed his hat.
First Citizen, I'm yours to command. Fleet Admiral, your loyalty will not be forgotten. Mont Morale is in the hands of madmen, the planet infested with traitors, and we must do whatever is necessary to cleanse our beloved Union.
Gaston Villeneuve turned toward the other figure in the small group of three. He was still weak, and he'd given up trying to count the number of separate places on his body that hurt. But he had more important things to deal with just then, like holding on to his power.
Yours as well, dear.
I am quite impressed by the number of Sector 9 agents you have brought under your wing, especially when many at the highest ranks of the agency have descended to disloyalty and treason. You will both find me most appreciative and grateful. You are the rightful first citizen of the Union. If we allow failed revolutionaries to seize power, killing thousands of innocent civilians in the process, what are we? Not a government, certainly. You have my loyalty, first citizen, as always. But I must ask one thing of you, your solemn assurance that when we have defeated the traitors, you will do all that is necessary to clean house, to root out every disloyal official, every would-be rebel. The rot must be ripped out, root and branch to ensure the future. Tia Salamanca was particularly vicious, even for a career Sector 9 enforcer, and it showed in her tone. Villeneuve had already promised her the top position in the agency once the coup was crushed, but he'd also made a mental footnote to get rid of her once he didn't need her anymore. She was too brutal, too smart. She could be a threat one day. And Gaston Villeneuve had promised himself, once the current crisis was over, he could cut off potential dangers at the root. Villeneuve stared back at Salamanca, his eyes narrow, his look one as frozen as space. I can promise you, Tia, with absolute sincerity, that when this is all over, every conspirator, every sympathizer, every Union citizen that has failed to do his or her duty to deter and defeat the traitors will rue the day they were born. The word justice had never had a darker, more threatening sound. Very well, first citizen. The Admiral spoke before Salamanca could respond. I wish my first suggestion could be to blockade Montmorel now, to trap the treacheries there and to begin the cleansing at once, but I'm afraid that is impossible. Villeneuve knew that already, but hearing it from his cohort truly made it hit home. He had a disadvantage in the capital system, at least at that moment. Ciara had surprised him with her resilience and her pure audacity, though he was sure Karevsky had also been involved somehow. It had taken all he could muster not to order the Admiral to blast the Confed ambassador's ship to atoms, but the last thing he needed was trouble with the Confeds, at least while he was dealing with the insurrection. Besides, the ship was sitting under the guns of the orbital forts, and Villeneuve didn't control those. But once he'd crushed Ciara and her followers and re-established himself in uncontested control of the government, you would see the Confeds were repaid for their interference, no matter how long it took. I am inclined to agree with you, Admiral, that the intelligence move now is to pull back and organize. We must rally support among the military and on the other worlds. We will have to leave the system at once, first citizen. It is shameful, perhaps, but that traitor, Rien, has managed to gain control over the system defenses, both the fortresses and the patrol fleet. Our forces here are inadequate to guarantee your safety, much less to attack and destroy the traitors, as I would like. The future of the Union is in our hands, and there is no room for carelessness, for unnecessary chances. We must go and rally the battle fleets, ensure that none of the heavy units, or as few as possible, fall into the hands of the conspirators. Indeed, Admiral, I agree entirely. It galled Villeneuve to be chased away from his capital, but his instincts had rarely betrayed him before. He didn't have enough strength in the Gasara system, at least not enough to be sure of victory. He had to move first and quickly. The struggle for power would ultimately hinge on who secured control of more military assets. He liked to think he would easily secure all the fleet's heavy battle units, but he stopped himself. He couldn't underestimate Ciara again, and General Rien had contacts throughout the Navy. Some unit commanders would likely declare for the new government. His first thoughts had been of quick fixes, of crushing the rebels, exterminating any who supported them. But the fight before him would be longer, more difficult than that. The situation had gone beyond a coup, beyond the machinations of groups of plotters and troops moving about in the dark. Things were about to get ugly. Very, very ugly. The Union was about to erupt into civil war. Chapter 38 CFS Dauntless Atara Mordlin System Year 322 AC The Battle of Pharsalon Baron's Choice Baron stared at the display, unmoving, his eyes fixed on the enemy ships approaching his position. He could see Kronos' forces as well, clearly beginning a run for the transit point. If it hadn't been for the flanking force, a good number of them would have made it out. Baron was sure of that. They would have paid, heavily, but they'd have salvaged a force and being, lived to fight another day. But now they were doomed.
A few ships might make it through, but the fleet as a fighting unit would be destroyed, and with it, any hope the hegemony had of resisting the enemy invasion. Any hope the Rim had, too. There's no way we can face this enemy alone. His head ached, a pounding pain like a drum behind his temples. He'd saved his own force, all except the three ships remaining in the system. There was time to pull them out as well. He could leave Atar Mordlin without losses, and while part of him rejoiced at the lack of casualties, it made him feel somehow dirty to flee without harm when the cream of the hegemony fleet was about to be obliterated. He watched the enemy forces analyze their vectors. They'd been coming in on a line toward his ships, but they'd adjusted their course as his forces had withdrawn, and now they were moving several light minutes in-system from the point. Baron felt a surge of anger, a resentment that his force had been dismissed as a threat. Admittedly, his ships had run. The only three remained in Atar Mordlin. His trio of battleships was hardly a threat to the enemy, at least by any conventional standards. Though pride surged out from the depths of his thoughts and asserted that three of the best battleships in the Confederation Navy were a threat to anyone. His mind rehashed the rules of engagement, the orders the Senate had given him. Clearly, the situation warranted action. His ships were on the flank of the enemy flanking force, and though the bulk of his force had transited, they'd gone through at minimal velocities. They could reverse their vectors very quickly in return, if Baron sent for them. But he was forbidden to engage. There was no leeway, no latitude. If he attacked the enemy flanking force, he would do so in direct violation of the Senate's orders. Worse, the officers who obeyed his commands would be equally guilty. The rules of engagement had been published throughout the fleet, and every ship commander, every bridge officer would know any order to attack was mutinous. Baron might throw his career away to do what he believed was right. He might even risk spending the rest of his life in a military stockade, or worse. But how could he do that to his people? They were loyal, devoted. If he ordered them in, if he asked them to follow him, he doubted one in a thousand would refuse. He told himself their actions would be their choice, that they had their own free will, but he didn't believe that was really true. Not in this case. And yet would he be serving them by allowing the hegemony to be defeated? He had no doubt now the Rim would be next, and that it would fall. The families, the loved ones of all his spacers, they would die, or become slaves. If anything was worth fighting for, wasn't preventing such a fate? He was silent, deep in his own tortured mind, and then he made his choice. Atara. Repulse is closest to the transit point. They are to send a shuttle through with orders for the fleet to return at once at maximum possible speed, fully prepared for battle.
Yes, sir.
He could hear the energy and excitement in her voice. There was no mistake, at least, that Admiral Atara Travis was a willing participant in the mutiny about to take place. He turned and looked at the approaching enemy ships. If he plotted the right vector, he could catch them just as they were forming up to meet Cronus's escaping ships. The enemy was vastly superior in technology, but Baron's ships would have the positional advantage, at least at first. And he would make it count. There was only one problem. He'd have some real force when the rest of the fleet returned, but until then, he had to make three ships count. Atara, Dauntless, Repulse, and Indomitable are to set a course for 135.208.360 maximum thrust.